All through Baltimore, the struggle between law and opportunity continued, but most of the citizens allied themselves with neither side. The unlicensed coffee shop, filled with customers looking for a cheap way to make their dinners on basics seem more palatable, and then with younger people who either didn't have the currency or else the inclination to take amphetamines before descending to the one-night rye clubs on barricaded streets. A few parents came home from actual jobs, proud to spend real money for a stale muffin,
and give their credits to the gray market daycares run out of neighborhood living rooms.
Very few people stood wholly for the law or wholly against it, and so, for them, the catastrophe of the churn was an annoyance to be avoided or endured, or else a titillation on the news feeds. That it was a question of life and death for other people spoke in its favor as entertainment. Erich, sitting at the rented deck with a news feed spooling past, felt the distance between himself and the others who shared his space more keenly than they did. His sense of dread of a chapter of his own life ending was unnoticed by the heavy-set woman who brewed the coffee and the thin man at the edge of the rooftop who spent his hours sending messages about tangled romantic involvements. To the other habitués of the coffee shop, Erich was just the crippled man who was hogging the deck. An annoyance and an amusement, and no one would particularly notice or care if he vanished from the world. Timmy arrived just after midnight, his broad, amiable smile softening the distance in his eyes. To anyone who didn't look at him closely, he seemed unthreatening, and no one looked at him closely. He pulled a welded steel chair up to the bolted-down deck and sat at Eric's side. The newsfeed was set to local. A pale-skinned woman with the Outer Planets Association split circle tattooed on her sternum and Loca Griega teardrops on her cheeks had blood pouring from her nose and left eye while she struggled against two Star Helix enforcers in gears so thick they barely seemed human. Eric smiled, trying to hide the relief he felt at Timmy's return. "Loca," Eric said, nodding at the feed. "They're having a bad night, too."
"A lot of that going around," Timmy said.
"Yeah, right. You heard from Burton?"
"No. Didn't try to find them yet, either," Timmy said with a shrug. "You want to hang out here some more, or are you about ready to go?"
"I don't know where to go," Eric said, a high violin whine coming in at the back of his voice.
"I got that covered," Timmy said.
"You got a bolt hole? Jesus, that's where you've been all this time, isn't it? Getting someplace safe to hide."
"Kind of, but, you know. You ready?"
"I need to stop someplace. Get a deck." Timmy frowned and nodded at the table before them.
"There's one right here," was in his eyes.
Eric pointed at the bolts anchoring the machine to the wooden tabletop. Timmy's expression went empty and he stood up.
"Hey," Eric said.
Timmy, what are you? The thick woman who brewed the coffee looked up at the broad-shouldered young man. The coffee bar had been hers for 3 years, and she'd seen enough of the regulars to recognize trouble.
"Hey," the large man, boy, really, said, his voice making the word half apology. "So, look, I don't mean to be a dick or anything, but I kind of need that deck."
"You can use it here, you buy some coffee. Our rates are printed on the side," the woman said, crossing her arms. The big kid nodded, his brow knotting. He took a scuffed and stained black market credit chip and pressed it into her palm. "Shit, Jones," she said, blinking at the credit balance on the tiny LED display. "How much coffee you want?" The kid had already turned back to the table where the cripple with the baby arm had been sitting all day. He hit the table with his fist hard enough that everyone on the rooftop turned to look at him. After the third hit, the wood of the tabletop started to splinter. There was blood on the big boy's knuckles, and the cripple was shifting back and forth anxiously as the table fell to sticks and splinters. The boy pulled her little deck free with a creaking sound. The bolts still hung from it, the wood torn out from around them. Blood dripped from his hands as he tucked the machine under his arm and nodded to the cripple.
Anything else you need?
Timmy asked. Eric had to fight not to smile.
No, I think I'm good now.
All right then, we should go.
Timmy turned to the woman and lifted his swelling hand to her in a wave.
Thanks.
She didn't say anything, but pushed the credit stick into her apron and waddled back to get a broom. They were gone before she returned, walking down the stairway to the street.
That was incredible, Eric said. The way you did that? I mean, damn it! Everyone in there was cold as stone, and you were just madness and power, man. Did you see that? Did you see how gassed they were at you?
You said you needed the deck, Timmy said.
Come on, that was critical. You can brag about it some.
Tables don't fight back, Timmy said. Come on, I got a boat.
Eric's relief left him chatty, but he didn't talk about the fear he'd felt when Timmy had left him. Instead, he filled the trip with everything he'd seen on the feeds, and he told it all like he was telling ghost stories. The security forces were watching the ports, the trains, the transports up to the orbitals and Luna. 18 dead today, maybe 3 times that many in custody. It was news all over the world, and farther. There had even been a lady from Mars who'd come on for a while talking about the history of Earth-based police states. Wasn't that cool? All the way to Mars, they were talking about what was going on right then in Baltimore. They were everywhere. Timmy listened, adding in a few words here and there, but mostly he walked until they reached the water, and then he rowed. The ceramic oars dipped into the dark water and lifted out again. Eric drummed his fingertips against the stolen deck, anxious to reconnect it to the network, to see what was happening and what had changed in the time since they'd left the coffee bar. That being connected would somehow protect him was an illusion, and Eric half knew that, but only half. At the little island, Timmy pulled the boat onto shore and marched into the ruins where a light was burning. An old woman was sitting beside a chemical stove, stirring a small tin pot. The smell of brewing tea competed with the brine and the reek of decaying jellyfish. She looked up. Her face was like a mask, the makeup applied so perfectly it shoved her back into the uncanny valley.
I found your tea, she said. I hope you don't mind.
Nope, Timmy said, not breaking stride. Come on, Eric, I'll get you set up.
They walked through a doorway without a door and into a small room. It was even less comfortable than the one with the old lady. There was nothing on the floor but the glue marks where there had once been carpeting. Mold grew up along one wall, black and branching like tree limbs. Timmy put the deck on the ground. His knuckles were black with blood and forming scab.
You be able to get signal here? Timmy asked.
Should be. Maybe need to find a way to power up in the morning.
Yeah, well, we'll come up with something. So, this is your room, okay? Yours. That one's hers, Timmy said, pointing a thumb at the lighted doorway. Hers. She asks you in, you can go in. But she asks you to leave, you do it. Right?
Of course. Sure. Christ, Timmy. Your place, your rules, right?
Eric smiled, hoping to coax one in response.
We've always respected each other, right? Only seriously, who is she? Is that your mom?
It was like Timmy hadn't heard him.
I'm gonna get some sleep, but come morning I can go back in, get some food. And I'll check in with the man.
Eric felt his belly go cold.
You're going to talk to Burton?
Sure, if I can find him, Timmy said. He's got the plan, right?
Right, Eric said.
Of course.
He opened the deck, ran it through its startup options, and connected to the network. The signal strength wasn't great, but it wasn't awful. He'd been in half a dozen basement hack shacks with worse. He opened the news feed, still set to passive. The glow from the screen was the only light. Eric was cold, but he didn't complain. Timmy stood, stretched, considered the skinned knuckles of his hand with what could have been a distant sort of ruefulness, and turned to go back to the old woman and the light. Hey, we're friends, right? Eric said. Timmy turned back.
Sure.
We've always watched out for each other, you and me. Timmy shrugged.
Not always, but when we could, sure.
Don't tell him where I am, okay?
Security crackdowns, like plagues, had a natural progression. A peak, and then decline. As terrible as they might be at their height, they did not last forever. Burton knew this, as did all of his lieutenants, and he made his plans accordingly. Burton moved through his safe houses, playing shell games with the security forces. The first night, while Eric and Lydia slept in their respective rooms in the little island ruin, and Timmy tried to find someone in the organization to report to, Burton slept in a loft above a warehouse with a woman named Edie. In the morning, he moved to the storage in the back of a medical clinic, locking the door and hijacking an untraceable connection so that he could speak to his people with relative safety. Little Cole had closed down her houses, locked away her reports, buried a month's supply of drugs, and taken a bus to Vermont to stay with her mother until things died down. Oystra was still in the city, moving from place to place in much the same fashion that Burton was. Ragman and Cyrano were missing, but it was early enough that Burton wasn't concerned yet. At least, they weren't in the news feeds. Leave and Simonson were. And there was other evidence, indirect but convincing, of where the little war stood. Even in the first morning after the catastrophe began, security teams were calling on Leave's underlings, sweeping them up for questioning. Some they held, others they released. Burton had no way of knowing which of those who had been set free had cut deals with security and which had been lucky enough to slip through the net. It hardly mattered. That branch of the business had been compromised, and so it would die. The demand for illicit drugs, cheap goods, off-schedule medical procedures, and anonymous sex could be neither arrested nor sated, and so the thing that mattered most for Burton's little empire was safe, would always be safe. The question of how to feed the city's subterranean hungers was only a tactical one, and Burton could be flexible. The temptation, of course, was to fight back. And in the following days, some did. 5 soldiers from the Loca Griega left a bomb outside a Star Helix substation. It exploded, injuring 2 of the security contractors and damaging the building, and all 5 bombers were identified and taken into custody. Tamara Sludin, who really should have known better, organized street-level resistance, starting a 2-day riot that ended with 1/2 of her people hospitalized or in custody, 18 local businesses looted or set afire, and the goodwill of her client base permanently damaged. Burton understood. He wasn't a man without passions. If someone hurt him, of course, he wanted to hurt them back. Phrases like, "even the score," or "blood for blood," came to mind, and each time they did, he made the practice of tearing them apart to himself. Even the score was the metaphor of a game, and this wasn't a game. Blood for blood made it sound as if through more violence, past wrongs could be balanced, and they couldn't. The hardest lesson Burton had ever learned was to endure the blows, accept the damage, and let someone else strike back. Soon, very soon, the crackdown would shift from its great overwhelming force to individual struggles. It was in his interests to see that those struggles were with the local Griega and Tamara Sludin, not with him. As soon as the enemy was clearly defined in the collective mind of Star Helix, and Burton's name and organization were not central to their plans, the storm would move on, and he could begin to reopen the folded fronds of his business. In the meantime, he moved from one place to the next.
He told people he would go one place and then arrived at another. He considered all his habits with the uncompromising eye of a predator and killed the ones with flaws. Anything that connected him with the patterns of the past was a vulnerability, and wherever possible, he chose to be invulnerable. It wasn't the first time he'd been through this. He was good at it. And so, when it took Timmy the better part of a week to find him, Burton's annoyance was balanced against a certain self-centered pride. The office was raw brick and mortar, news feeds playing on 5 different screens. A sliding wooden door stood half open, the futon where Burton had slept the night before, half visible through it. Oystra, whose safe house it was, sat by the window looking down at the street. The automatic shotgun across his leg seemed unremarkable. Timmy had been searched by 3 guards on the street, and he'd been clean. Even if he'd swallowed a tracking device, they would have found it, and the big slab of human meat would have been bleeding out in a gutter instead of smiling amiably and gawking at the exposed ductwork. "Timmy, right?" Burton said, pretending uncertainty. Let the boy feel lucky he'd remembered that much. "Yeah, Chief, that's me." The openness and amiability was annoying. Burton glanced toward Oystra, but the lieutenant was squinting at the brightness of the day. Burton scratched his leg idly, his fingernails hissing against the fabric of his pants. "You got something for me?" Timmy's face fell a little. "Just news. I mean, I didn't have any stuff. Nothing to deliver or anything." "All right then," Burton said. "What's the news, Tiny?" Timmy grinned at the irony of the nickname, then sobered and began his report. Burton leaned forward, drinking in all the words as fast as they spilled from Timmy's lips. When Oystra risked a glance back, it was like watching a bird singing away while a cat stood in the too still pose of a carnivore waiting to pounce. The details came out in no particular order. Eric was in a safe place. Timmy had been taking food to him. The fake profile deal had been interrupted by the security crackdown. Eric's original deck was gone, but he had a replacement. The police probably had his DNA profile now. Oystra sighed to himself and looked back out the window. On the street, a half dozen young men who hadn't just condemned their friends to death slouched down the street together. "He's sure about that?" Burton asked. "Nah," Timmy said. "We didn't hang around and watch them find the deck or anything. I figured it'd be better, you know, to get out."
"I see."
"Eric wanted to get out. Grab the hardware, I mean."
"That would have been a mistake," Burton said. "If security had the deck and the man, that'd be bad."
"Was what I thought too," Timmy said. Burton sat back, the leather of the chair creaking. Back past the bedroom, Sylvia started running the shower.
Sylvia or Sarah, something like that. One of Istra's, provided with the bed.
"Where's the safe house?"
"I'm not supposed to say," Timmy said.
"Not even to me?"
The boy had the good sense to look uncomfortable.
"Yeah, not to anyone. You know how it is."
"Is there anyone there with him?"
"Yeah, I got a friend there."
"A guard?"
"Not really, no, just a friend."
Burton nodded, thinking hard. "But he's secure."
"He's on the water. Anyone starts coming in, he's got a boat and about a dozen decent places to hide. I mean, nowhere's 100%.
"And you're protecting him?"
"That's the job," Timmy said with a shrug and a smile.
Burton couldn't quite put his finger on what it was about the boy that was so interesting. Over the years, he'd had hundreds just like him who came through, worked, disappeared, died, were fed to security, or found God and a ticket out of town. Burton had a nose for talent, though, and there was something about this one that kept bringing him back to the sense of the boy's potential. Perhaps it was the casual logic he'd used when he'd killed Austin. Maybe it was the deadness in his eyes. Burton got up, raising a finger. Timmy sat deep in his chair, like a trained dog receiving a command. Sylvia, whoever, was singing in the bathroom. The splash of water against porcelain covered the sound of Burton opening the gun safe, pulling out the pistol in its magazine. When he stepped back into the main room, Timmy hadn't so much as crossed his legs. Burton held the gun out.
"You know what this is?" he asked.
"It's a 10mm semi-auto," Timmy said. He put his hand out halfway to it and then looked up at Burton, his eyes asking permission. Burton nodded and smiled. Timmy took the gun.
"You know guns?"
Timmy shrugged. "They're around. It feels sticky."
"It's got a resin of digestive enzymes," Burton said.
"Won't hurt your skin much, but it won't hold prints, and it breaks down any trace of evidence. No DNA."
"That's cool,"
Timmy said, and started to hand it back. Burton tossed the magazine onto the boy's lap.
"Those are plastic-tipped organ shredders, but they don't work on armor," Burton said.
"Still, step up from that homemade shotgun you've used, right?"
"Right. You know how those things all go together?"
Timmy weighed the pistol in one hand, the magazine in the other. He slid them together, checked the chamber, flicked the safety on and off. It wasn't the practiced action of a professional, but talented amateur was good enough for his purposes. Timmy looked up, his smile blank and empty.
"New job?" he asked.
"New job," Burton said.
"I know you and Eric grew up together. Is this going to be a problem for you?"
"Nope,"
Timmy said, slipping the gun into his pocket. There hadn't even been a pause.
"You're sure?"
"Sure, I'm sure. I get it. They've got him in the system now. If they get him too, there's all kinds of things he compromises. If they can't get him, nothing gets compromised, and I'm the only guy who can get close to him without him seeing it coming."
"Yes."
"So I kill him for you," Timmy said.
He could have been saying, "So I'll pick up dinner on my way." There was no bravado in it. Burton sat, tilted his head. The friendly smile and the empty eyes met him.
"All right, I'm curious," Burton said. "Did you game this? This was your plan?"
"Shit, no, Chief," Timmy said. "This here's just happy coincidence."
Either it was truth or the best deadpan Burton had seen in a long time. The shower water turned off. On the news feeds, a woman in a Star Helix uniform was saying something, a dour expression on her face. Burton wanted to turn up the volume, see if the press statement was something useful to him, like reading fortunes and coffee grounds. He restrained himself.
"I will need proof," Burton said. "Evidence, yeah?"
"So what? You want his heart?"
"Heart, brain, windpipe, anything he can't live without."
"Not a problem," Timmy said. Then a moment later,
"Is there anything else, or should I go?"
"You watched out for this kid your whole life," Burton said. "He vouched for you, got you in with me. And you're really going to put a slug in his brain just like that?"
"Sure. You're the man with the plan."
When the boy left, Burton came to stand beside Oystra, watching him walk away down the sunlit street. The thinning reddish-brown hair and wide shoulders made him look like some kind of manual laborer twice his age. His hands were shoved deep in his pockets. He could have been anybody.
"Think he'll do it?" Burton asked.
Oystra didn't answer for a long moment.
"Might. He does this for me. He'll do anything," Burton said, clapping Oystra's shoulder. "Potential for a man like that."
"If he doesn't?"
"There are a lot of ways to dispose of someone disposable," Burton said.
Burton walked back to the chair, shifted the news feed buffer back to the start of the Star Helix woman's press announcement. The woman started talking, and Burton listened. Timmy's ruin had long since become a misery for Lydia, and misery had become a kind of pleasure. Their days had taken a kind of rhythm. Eric woke first in the morning, his uneven footsteps playing a tentative counterpoint to the rough sound of the waves. Lydia lay in the warmth of her cocoon, the slick fabric wrapped around her until only her mouth and nose were in the free air. When she could no longer pretend sleep, she emerged and made tea on the little stove, and when she was done, Eric transferred the solar charger to his deck and squatted over it, scanning the news feeds with a ferocity and single-mindedness that made her think of a poet chasing the perfect rhyme. If Timmy was there, she would walk with him to the boats or survey the newest supplies he had smuggled to their private island, fresh clothes, carry-out tandoori, charged batteries for the deck and the lamp. More often, he was not there, and she haunted the shore like a sea widow. The city glowered at her from across the water like a great, angry, gray face, condemning her for her sins. "Is this the time?" she would wonder. "Has he left now, never to return? Or will there be one more, another time to see his face, to hear his voice, to have the conversations that we can only ever have with each other?" She knew that the churn was playing itself out there, across the narrow waves. Security had likely come to her rooms on leave's word and found them already abandoned. The men and women she'd worked with these last years were part of the past now, part of a life she'd left behind, though nothing else had begun. Only this island exile, and its waiting. At night, Eric would eat with her. Their conversations were awkward. She knew that she was uncanny to him, that he thought of Timmy as his own friend, a character from his own past. Her appearance and the reticence she and Timmy had to making her explicable was as odd to Eric as if lobsters had crawled up out of the sea and started speaking Spanish. And yet, if they did, what could anyone do but answer them? And so Eric and Lydia reached the odd peace of roommates, intimate in all things and nothing. That night, Timmy crossed the waves unnoticed by her or Eric. Lydia was looking east over the ruined island to the greater sea beyond. Eric curled in the room that common habit designated as his, snoring slightly as the deck ran down its charge to nothing beside him. Timmy arrived quietly and alone, announced only by his footsteps and the smell of fresh ginger. When he emerged from the darkness, two thin plastic sacks hung from his left fist. Lydia shifted, not rising, but coming up to rest on her knees and ankles in a posture she imagined to be like a geisha, though she'd never met a real geisha. Timmy put the sacks down beside her, his eyes on the shadows past the doorway. Far away across the water, gulls complained. "Two?" she said. "Hm?" Timmy followed her gaze to the sacks. A glimmer of something that might have been chagrin passed through his eyes fast as a blink. "Oh, the dinners. Hey, is Eric back there?" "He is," Lydia said. "I think he's asleep." "Yeah," Timmy said, straightening. He put a hand into his pocket. "Hang on a minute." He walked back toward the black doorway, as if he were going to check on the other boy, perhaps wake him for his supper. "Wait," Lydia said as Timmy reached the doorway. He looked back at her, twisting at the shoulders, his body and feet still committed. "Come, sit with me."
"Yeah, I just gotta..."
"First," she said. "Come sit with me first." Timmy hesitated, fluttering like a feather caught between contradictory breezes. Then his shoulders sank a centimeter and his hips turned toward her. He pulled his hand from his pocket. Lydia opened the sacks, unpacked the food, laid the disposable forks beside the plates. Every movement had the precision and beauty of ritual. Timmy sat facing her, his legs crossed. The bulge of the gun stood out from his thigh like a fist. Lydia bowed her head as if in prayer. Timmy took up his fork and stabbed at the ginger beef. Lydia did the same.
So, you're going to kill him? Lydia asked, her voice light.
Yeah, Timmy said. I mean, I ain't happy about it, but it's what needs to get done.
Needs, Lydia said, her intonation in the perfect balance point between statement and question. Timmy ate another bite.
I'm the guy that took a job from Burton. Used to be the job was one thing, now it's something else. It's not like I get to tell him what to do, right?
Because he's Burton.
And I'm not. You're the one who said I'd be important to him if I made it through this shitstorm. This is part of that.
I said Burton would see you as important, Lydia said. There is more to you than what he sees. There's more to you than what anybody sees.
Well, Timmy said, you.
Even I do not know your depths, floated at the back of her throat like a cough. She didn't have it in her to say the words. If it was true, so what? When had truth ever been her friend? Instead, she took another bite of the beef. He did the same. She imagined that he was giving her the time to gather herself. It might even have been true. The perfectly straight lightning bolt of a railgun transport lit the black sky, its thunder rolling after it like a wave. The ginger and pepper burned her lips, her throat, her tongue, and she took another bite, welcoming the pain. It was always pleasant when pain was on the outside. And who will you be to yourself? She said at last. Doesn't what you think matter more than what he does?
Timmy's brow furrowed.
Yeah, I don't know what you just said. Who are you going to be to yourself if you do this?
She put down her fork, leaned across the space between them. She lifted his shirt as she had countless times before, and the erotic charge of it was still there, never absent. She pressed her palm against his breast, her skin against his skin and the place above his heart. Who will you be in there?
Timmy's face went perfectly still in the unnerving way it sometimes did.
His eyes were flat as a shark's, his mouth like a plaster cast mold of himself. Only his voice was the same, bright and amiable.
You know there ain't no one in there, he said.
She let her fingertips stray to the side, brushing through the coarse hair she knew so well. She felt the hardness of his nipple against her thumb.
Then who will you put there? Burton? He's the guy with the power, Timmy said.
Not the power to kill Eric, she said. Not the power to make you kill him.
That is you, and only you. People like us, we aren't righteous. But we can pretend to be if we want. And that's almost the same as if it were true. I get the feeling you're asking me for something. I don't know what it is.
I am not a good person, she said.
Hey, don't.
If I were, though, if I were that woman, what would I want you to do?
Timmy took another mouthful of beef, his jaw working slowly. In his concentration, she saw the echoes of all the versions of himself that she had known from baby to toddler to young man to this now before her. She folded her hands on her lap.
That's a long way to say I shouldn't do it, he said.
Is that what I said? She asked.
Eric's yawn came from the doorway. Lydia felt the blood rush from her face, tasted the penny-bright flush of fear as if she had been caught doing something illicit. Eric came into the light, scratching his sleep-tousled hair with his good hand.
Hey, he said. Did I hear you get back, big guy? What's the word?
Timmy was quiet, his gaze fixed on Lydia, his expression empty as a mask.
Guys? Eric said, limping forward. What's the matter? Is something wrong?
Timmy's sigh was so low that Lydia barely heard it. The boy she had loved for so long and in so many ways put on his cheerful smile and looked away from her. She felt tears pricking her eyes.
Yeah, bad news,
Timmy said. Burton's not taking the whole thing very well. He's put out paper on you. Eric sat down, the blood draining from his face. He grabbed his bad arm reflexively, unaware that he was doing it, and looked from Timmy to the woman and back. His heart thudded like a drum in his ears. Timmy licked his fork clean and put it down. The woman was still as stone. Eric felt his world fall out from underneath him, and that he had known it would was less of a comfort than he'd expected. Anyone looking in at the little circle of light from the shadows would have seen only three faces in the black, like a family portrait of refugees. Eric broke the silence.
Are you sure?
Yeah, pretty sure, Timmy said, seeing as how I got the contract. Eric stopped breathing. Timmy stared at him, expressionless for several infinitely long seconds.
We've got to find a way to get you out, his big friend finally said.
And Eric started breathing again. There's no way out, he said. Burton will track me down anywhere.
What about that deck? Timmy asked. It ain't your old one, but can you still sample with it?
What do you mean? Eric said.
You've got the escape plan for Burton, the clean one. Why don't you put your sequence on it? Use it to get out of here.
I can, sure, but they've already got my other deck, remember? I put my DNA on a record, the flag goes up, and I'm in for questioning.
Yeah, Timmy said. Well, maybe you could... Shit, I don't know. Maybe you could think of something.
I knew, Eric said. The second I saw those bastards coming down the street, I knew it was over for me. I'm dead. It's just a matter of time, is all.
That's always true, Lydia said, her mind taken with other matters. For everyone.
Might as well be you, Eric said to Timmy, giving his friend permission, terror and love warring in his chest.
No, Timmy said, cocking his head to one side as if he'd only just made the decision in that moment.
Eric, Lydia started. As long as I'm alive, Eric said, ignoring her, Burton's not safe. He's not going to let me slide.
Timmy frowned, then grunted in surprise. Maybe pleasure.
What? Eric said.
Just that it works the other way, too, Timmy said, levering himself up to his feet. Anyway, I gotta go back in.
Back in? Eric said. Timmy brushed his hands across his wide thighs.
The city. I gotta go back to the city. Burton's expecting me.
You're not going to tell him where I am, are you? Eric asked.
Timmy started laughing, and Lydia took it up. Eric looked from one to the other, confused.
Nah, I'm not gonna tell him where you are. I got something of his I need to give back, is all. Nothing you have to worry about.
Easy for you to say. Eric said, ashamed of the whine in his voice.
I'll leave you the good boat, Timmy said, turning toward the darkness. Will you be back? Lydia said.
She hadn't meant to, because she knew in her heart, in her bones, and deeper than that, what the answer was. Timmy smiled at her for the last time.
I take it back, she thought. Kill him. Kill the boy. Kill everyone else in the world. Shoot babies in the head and dance on their bodies. Any atrocity, any evil is justified if it keeps you from leaving me.
Timmy said. You never know.
The darkness folded around him as he walked away. Her hands were made of lead and tungsten. Her belly felt hurt and empty as a miscarriage. And underneath the hurt and the horror, the betrayal and the pleasure she took in her distress, something else stirred and lifted its head. It took her time to recognize it as pride, and even then she couldn't have said who or what she was proud of, only that she was. The boat splashed once in the water, her almost son and sometime lover leaving the shore for the last time. Her lifetime was a fabric woven of losses, and she saw now that all of them had been practice, training her to teach her how to bear this pain like a boxer bloodying knuckles to make them strong and numb. All her life had been preparation for bearing this single, unbearable moment.
Shit, Eric said. Were there only two dinners? What am I going to eat?
Lydia plucked up the fork that had been Timmy's, gripping the stem in her fist, like holding his hand again one last time. Touching what he had touched because she would never touch him again. Here, this object had opened his lips, felt the softness of his tongue, and been left behind. It held traces of him. What's the matter? Eric said. Are you all right?
I stopped being all right before you were born, she thought.
What she said was, there's something I'd like you to do for me. The streets of Baltimore didn't notice him pass through them this one last time. More than 3 million people lived and breathed, loved and lost, hoped and failed to hope that night, just as any other. A young woman hurrying home later than her father's curfew dodged around a tall man with thinning hair and pants wet to the knee at the corner of South and Lombard, muttering obscenities and curses at him that spoke more of her own dread and fear than anything the man had done. 4 Star Helix security employees, out of uniform and off shift, paused at the entrance to an Italian restaurant to watch a civilian pass. None of them could have said what it was about him that caught their attention, and it might only have been that they'd operated on high alert for so many days at once. The civilian went on, minding his own business, keeping himself to himself, and they went into the building's garlic and onion smells and forgot him. A bus driver stopped, let 2 old women, a thin-faced man, and a broad-shouldered, amiable fellow come on board. Bus service was part of basic, and the machine followed its route automatically. No one paid, no one spoke, and the driver went back to watching the entertainment feeds as soon as the bus pulled back into traffic. Nearer Oystra's safe house, things changed. There were more eyes, more of them alert. The catastrophe of the churn hung thick in the air, the sense that doom might come at any moment in the shape of security vans and riot gear and voices shouting to keep hands visible. Nothing like it had happened that day, or the one before, but no one was taking comfort in that yet. The guards who stopped Timmy were different than the ones he'd seen earlier, but their placement on the street was the same. They stopped him, took the pistol that Burton had given him, scanned him for tracking devices, firearms, explosives, chemical agents, and when they found he was clean, they called in. Oystra's voice through their earpieces was less than a mosquito, but still perfectly recognizable, a familiar buzz and whine. They waved Timmy on. Oystra opened the door to him, automatic shotgun still in the lieutenant's hand as if he hadn't put it down all day. Probably he hadn't. Timmy stepped into the main room, looking around pleasantly. The news feeds flickered silently on their screens. A street view from sometime earlier in the day with 5 security vans lined up outside a burning apartment building. A serious-faced Indian woman speaking into the camera with a dour expression, an ad with 7 bouncing monkeys reaching for a box of banana-flavored cakes. The world cast its shadows on the bare brick wall and threw stories into the gray mortar. The churn, returning itself to exhaustion. New stories from around the world and above it, filling the void.
You're back, Oystra said.
Yup. You do the thing?
It got a little complicated, Timmy said.
The man's still here?
Wait, I'll get him.
Oystra walked to the back, one set of footsteps fading into the safe house, then a long pause made rich by the murmur of voices, then 2 sets of footsteps coming back. The timestamp beside the dour Indian woman read, 21:42. Timmy considered the curtains. Blue-dyed cotton with cords of woven nylon. The chair Oystra had been sitting on before. Leather stretched over a light metal frame. A kitchen in through a wide brickwork archway. The bedroom in the back with its futon, and a bathroom somewhere behind that.
Tiny, Burton said. What's the news, little man?
Burton's white shirt caught the light from the screens, dancing in 100 colors. His slacks were dark and beautifully cut. Timmy turned to him like he was an old friend. Oystra walked past them both, taking his place by the window. Timmy glanced back at him, only a few feet away, a shotgun across his thighs.
Well, Timmy said, truth is, I ran into a little hiccup.
Burton crossed his arms, squared his shoulders and hips.
Something you couldn't handle? He asked, his voice hard with disapproval.
I'm waiting to see, Timmy said.
Waiting to see if you can handle it?
Well, yeah, Timmy said with a wide, open smile. Actually, it's kind of funny you put it that way. When the big man stepped back toward the window, the movement was so casual, so relaxed, that neither Oystra nor Burton recognized what was happening. Timmy's thick fingers grabbed the back of the leather chair, pulling back and down fast and hard. Oystra twisted, trying to keep from falling and also bring the shotgun to bear at the same time, managing neither. He spilled to the floor, Timmy's knee coming down hard on his neck. Oystra's muffled roar was equal parts outrage and pain. Timmy reached down and ripped the man's right ear off, then punched down twice, three times, four. Burton ran for the back bedroom. There wasn't much time. Unable to use it with Timmy on his neck, Oystra dropped the shotgun and twisted, trying to get his arms and legs under himself, trying to get the leverage to push Timmy back. Timmy reached down and hooked his finger into the gunman's left eye, bracing the head with his knee and turning his wrist until he felt the eyeball pop. Oystra's screams were wilder now, panic and pain taking over. Timmy let the pressure up, scooted to the left, and picked up the abandoned shotgun. He fired once into Oystra's head, and the man stopped screaming. Timmy trotted across the room, shotgun in one hand. Burton boiled out of the bedroom, pistols in either fist and teeth bared like a dog's. The front window shattered. Timmy ducked through the brick archway into the kitchen, shifted his grip on the shotgun, and swung it hard and low, leading with the elbow like a cricket player at the bat as Burton roared in after him. The sound of the connection was like a piece of raw steak being dropped on concrete. Burton's feet flew out from under him, but the momentum of his rush carried him stumbling into the space beyond. Timmy lowered the shotgun toward the man's head, but Burton whirled, dropping his own guns and grabbing the shotgun's barrel. The smell of burning skin was instantaneous. Timmy tried to pull back, but Burton kicked out. His right foot hit Timmy's knee like he'd kicked a fire hydrant, but Timmy still stumbled. The shotgun roared again, and the refrigerator sprouted pocks of twisted metal and plastic. Burton twisted, pulling himself in close, too close for the shotgun's long barrel. He hammered his elbow into Timmy's ribs twice and felt something give the third time. Timmy dropped the shotgun, and then they were both down on the floor. They grappled, caught in each other's arms, each man shifting for the position that would destroy the other in a parody of intimate love. The fingers of Burton's left hand worked their way under Timmy's chin, digging at his neck, pushing into the hard cartilage of his throat. Timmy choked, gagged, pulled back the centimeter that was all Burton needed. He pulled his right arm up into the gap, braced himself, twisted, and now Timmy's arm and head were locked. Burton gasped out a chuckle.
"You just fucked the wrong asshole," he hissed as Timmy bucked and struggled.
Your little cripple boyfriend, I'm gonna burn him down for days. I'm gonna find everyone you ever loved and kill them all slow.
Timmy grunted and pushed back, but the effort only made Burton's lock on him tighter.
You thought you could take me, you dumb fuck piece of shit?
Burton spat into Timmy's ear.
You thought you were tougher than me? I owned your mama, boy. You're just second-generation property.
All along their paired bodies, Burton felt Timmy tense and then, with a vast exhalation, relax, melting into the hold. Burton pulled tighter, squeezing. There was a report like a pistol shot when Timmy's shoulder dislocated and the resistance stuttered. Burton's grip broke. Timmy rolled, cocked back his fist, and brought it down on the bridge of Burton's nose. The pain was bright. The volume of the world faded. The fist came down again, jostling the kitchen. The light seemed strange, reducing the red of the bricks and the yellow of the stove to shades of gray. Burton tried to bring his arms up to cover his face, to shield him from the violence, but they were a very long way away, and he kept losing track of them. He had them up, but they were numb and boneless. The attacks easily brushed them aside. The fist hit his nose again, and he didn't know if it was for the third time or the fourth.
Shit, he thought. This is just going to keep going until that fucker decides to stop.
The impact came again, and Burton tried to say something, to scream. The impact came again, and afterward followed a few seconds of darkness and silence and calm. Burton felt very sleepy. The impact came again. Calm. The impact came again and again. And again. Each time, the violence felt more distant, and the emptiness between more profound, until a kind of forgetfulness came over him. Once Timmy was sure that he was alone in the apartment, he rolled onto his back. His left arm hung from the socket, limp, useless, and disconnected. He levered himself up to his knees, breathing hard between clenched teeth. Then stood. He took the automatic shotgun in his one good hand and stepped out to the main room. On the screen, the Indian woman was still speaking, wagging a finger at the camera to make a point. The timestamp beside her read 21:44. 2 minutes. Maybe a little less. Timmy walked to the front window. The guards from the street weren't at their posts. He nodded to himself and went to stand by the front door. When the knob turned, he waited. The door flew open and he fired 3 times, once straight ahead and then angling to the left and right. Someone started screaming and the door banged closed again. Timmy went back to the kitchen. He flipped on the burners, pulled down the roll of cheap paper towels from the wall. He found a bottle of peanut oil in the cabinet and doused the towels with half of it before he put them directly on the heating element. A flurry of footsteps came from the front, and he fired the shotgun again, not aiming at anything. They retreated. The oil-soaked paper caught fire, and Timmy picked up the burning roll, trotted to the bedroom, and threw the flaming mass into the bunched covers. By the time he was back in the kitchen, the flame shadows were already dancing in the archway behind him. Timmy put the half-full bottle of oil directly onto the heating element and walked to the back of the safe house. The stairway leading to the alley was narrow and white. He didn't see anyone, but he fired the shotgun twice anyway, then tossed the gun back into the fire. If there had been a guard there, they'd fled. Timmy walked out into the night. He moved slowly, but with purpose. When his path crossed with other people's, he smiled and nodded. Once, when he had almost reached his destination, an old man in a black coat had stopped and stared at his bruised and bloodied hand. Timmy smiled ruefully, shrugged, and didn't break stride. The old man didn't raise an alarm. Around here, a muscle-bound thug with blood on his cuffs and skinned knuckles didn't warrant anything more than a disapproving look. The security forces had put a fresh lock on Lydia's door, but Timmy knew the back way in. He slid through the window into the bathroom he'd known so well over the last few years. It still smelled like her. They'd gone through everything. Her towels and the shower curtain were on the floor. Bottles of medications littered the sink. He dug through until he found some painkillers and dry swallowed three. In the kitchen, he wrapped his shoulder in ice, then waited motionless until the swelling was down as far as it was going to go. Putting his shoulder back in its socket was a question of lying on the bed, his grip on the mattress bottom hard and unforgiving, then pulling back slowly, relaxing into the pain until it slid back into place with a wet, angry pop. He stripped, washed himself with wet hand towels, and changed into a fresh set of his clothes, ones that didn't have anybody's blood on them. The churn, the crackdown, the catastrophe, the cycle of boom and bust, the turn of the seasons. Whatever name was applied to it, the inevitable cascade of events in the city rolled on just the same. When the fire trucks came and put out the blaze, they identified the two bodies as Fievel Oystra and an unregistered man. The unregistered was a small, compact, dark-skinned man in an expensive shirt and tailored slacks. He had no tattoos, and a wide birthmark on his right shoulder blade in the shape of a rough triangle. Both men had died by violence. If the fire had been meant to conceal that, it failed. If it was only meant to foul any trace DNA or fingerprint evidence, it did well enough. Add to that the fact that Oystra was on the Star Helix lists as someone to bring in for questioning, and the broad strokes of the story came clear. The same night, 15 men loyal to the local Griega were surrounded in a nightclub. The hostage situation that rose out of it left 2 people dead and 10 in custody, and the attendant lawsuits against Star Helix and the owners of the nightclub were the top of the local and regional news feeds. Oystra's death was little more than a footnote, something mentioned and then moved on from. Other things, smaller things, fell even below that level of obscurity. A woman selling illicit painkillers out of her apartment beside the Arcology had a screaming fight with one of her clients, called security, and was taken away for questioning. A sweep of the ruins on the Bay Islands found a small squatter's camp with an LED lamp, an emergency prep sleeping bag, and an exhausted chemical stove. But anyone who had been living there was gone. An art dealer, contacted with a request for assistance with an investigation, killed himself rather than come in. None of those events raised any notice at all. Soon, the paroxysm of violence, legal and otherwise, would thin back down to the normal background radiation of human vice. Very serious people would argue about whether the program had worked. Some would argue that crime had gone down, others that it had actually risen. Star Helix would take its payment from the government and settle out of court most of the complaints made against it. One of the remaining lieutenants would rise to the top, or the whole criminal apparatus would turn over to a new organization, a new generation. Within a year, there would be a new working normal that would run more or less gracefully. Until the next time. People of little importance would survive and make names for themselves. The mighty would fall, the meek would rise up in their places and become mighty, but all that would come later. In the pearly light that came before the dawn, one other thing happened that went unnoticed, meaningless to anyone but those involved. It was on a street down near the water's edge. The eastern sky was brightening with the coming dawn. The western sky still boasted a scattering of stars. Traffic on the street was thick, but not yet the immobile crush that would come with the light. Sea and rot perfumed the air, but the cool made the scent seem almost pleasant. A tea and coffee stand was opening, sporting the blue and pink logo of a popular chain and a tray of baked goods just the same as a million other trays on 5 continents and 2 worlds. Old men and women on basic huffed down the sidewalk, getting in the day's exercise before the sun came up. Young men and women staggered home from long nights at the street clubs and rai-rai joints, exhausted from hours of dancing, drinking, sex, and frustrated hope. Soon, the streets and tube stations would thicken with the traffic of those who had jobs to go to, and then be released to the masses for whom basic was a way of life. A boy, on the verge of manhood, stood on a corner near the tea and coffee stand. He was taller than average, and muscular. His close-cropped reddish-brown hair was receding, though he was young. His expression was blank, and he held himself in a tight, guarded way that could have been grief or the protecting of some physical injury. His right hand was swollen, the knuckles skinned. If it hadn't been for that last detail, the security team might have passed him by. 3 women and 2 men, all in the ballistic armor and helmets of Star Helix. "Morning," the team lead said, and half a beat later the tall man smiled and nodded. He turned to walk away, but the other personnel shifted to block his path. The man tensed, then made the visible decision to relax. His smile was rueful. "Sorry, I was just heading out." "I respect that, sir. We appreciate you taking a moment," the team lead said, placing a hand on the butt of his pistol. "Really did a number on your hand." "Yeah, I box. Can be a good workout. I'm going to need to see your ID." "Don't got it on me, sorry." "We'll need to check you against the database then." "That isn't a problem, is it? I think I got the right to refuse that, don't I?" "You do," the team lead said, letting a hint of hardness slip into his voice beneath the casual words. "But then we'd need to take you to the substation and do the full biometric scan to exclude you from the persons of interest list, and there are a whole lot of very unpleasant people who are in that queue. You don't want to hang out with them. Not if you have someplace you need to be." The big man seemed to consider this. He glanced back over his shoulder. "Looking for someone?" the team lead asked.
"Was more thinking there might be some folks looking for me."
"So, how do you want to play this?" The man shrugged and held out his hand. The team's data analyst stepped forward and tapped the collector against the thick wrist. The readout stuttered red, then went to solid green. The seconds ticked away. "If there's something you want to tell me," the team lead said, "this would be the time."
"Nah," the big man said. "I think I'm good."
"Yeah?"
"You know," he said. "Good enough."
The team lead's hand terminal chimed. He pulled it out with his left hand, his right still on the butt of his gun. The readout had the red border of a flagged profile. The big man's body went very still while they read. It was a long moment before the team lead spoke. "Amos Burton."
"Yeah?"
the big man said. It could have meant, "Yes, I killed him," or, "What about him?" All the team heard was the affirmation. "I've got a travel flag on you here. You're cutting it pretty close." Amos Burton's eyebrows rose, and the corners of his mouth turned down.
"I am?"
"You're shipping out to Luna on the noon launch from Bogota Station, Mr. Burton. His apprenticeship programs are tough to get into. And last I heard, they take it mighty poorly if you miss your berth. Might wind up waiting another decade to get back on the list."
"Huh,"
the big man said. "Look, there's a high-speed line about 9 blocks north of here. We can take you there if you want."
"Eric, you son of a bitch,"
the big man said. Instead of looking north, he turned to the east, toward the sea and rising sun.
"I'm not Mr. Burton."
"Sorry?"
"I'm not Mr. Burton," the man said again. "You can call me Amos.
Whatever you want.
But I think you better haul ass out of town if you don't want to get in some serious shit, Amos.
You ain't the only one that thinks that. But I'm good. I know where the high-speed lines are. I won't miss my ride.
All right, then, the team lead said with a crisp nod. Have a better one.
The security team moved on, flowing around the big man like river water around a stone. Amos watched them go, then went to the tea and coffee stand, bought a cup of black coffee and a corn muffin. He stood on the corner for a long minute, eating and drinking and breathing the air of the only city he'd ever known. When he was done, he dropped the cup and the muffin wrapper into the recycling bin and turned north toward the high-speed line and Bogota Station and Luna.
And who knew? Maybe the vastness beyond the moon, the sweep of planets and moons and asteroids that humanity had spread to, and where the chances of running into anybody from Baltimore were vanishingly small. A needle in a haystack, all of humanity wide. Amos Burton was a tall, stocky, pale-skinned man with an amiable smile, an unpleasant past, and a talent for cheerful violence. He left Baltimore to its dynamic balance of crime and law, exotics and mundanity, love and emptiness. The number of people who knew him and loved him could be counted on one hand and leave most of the fingers spare. And when he was gone, the city went on without him, as if he had never been.